blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see, bluebirds singing their song, nothing but bluebirds from now on. Never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right, noticing the days hurrying by, when you're in love, my eyes they fly. Blue days.
Do you believe in fate? Well, imagine having your life's calling come to you for a nickel. That's how much Sheila Jordan, a high school student in Detroit, Michigan, put in a jukebox to hear Charlie Parker play his famous composition, Now's the Time. She was hooked after the first four notes. She says, I instantly knew that was the music I had been waiting to hear and would dedicate my life to singing. And that's what she's been doing for 70 years now. Sheila Jordan cultivated a circle of friends that included not only Charlie Parker, but also Charles Mingus, Max Roach, Lee Konitz, and her former husband, Duke Jordan, among others. An innovative vocalist, a generous teacher, lifelong civil rights advocate, Ms. Jordan, who was recently honored with an NEA Jazz Master's Award, is the subject of a new biography called Jazz Child, A Portrait of Sheila Jordan by Ellen Johnson. I'm very pleased to welcome Sheila Jordan to our show.
Hello. Hi. It's great to be here.
And we opened with you singing with just a bass.
Yes.
It was one thing when Sonny Rollins did that sort of thing. But for a vocalist, that must be very difficult to just stay in tune.
Yeah, you have to be very careful. You know, it's a lot of tuning up and can't be a lot of noise in the room when you're performing, you know. Fans or refrigerators will set your intonation. You have to keep working on your pitch. But I've done it, and something I've done since 1950, maybe 52, something like that.
53. And you say that you think you were a bass player in a former life?
Yeah, well, I love the bass. I love the way it looks. I love the sound. And it's such a delicate instrument, and yet it's so huge.
But there are so many different styles of bass playing.
Yes.
You have to adjust to each. It's not the same thing as having a piano player play chords behind you.
Well, I choose the bass player because I do a whole concert of just bass and voice, and they're all little things that I've worked out. Like, I do a dance medley for Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I do a thing for Bird and Fats Waller. I do songs all together that I've put together. We made little excerpts from, you know, these great, great players. And then I do a thing on Miles. Actually, Blue Skies starts the Miles medley. Then I go into Miles and sing his solos.
You put words to his solos, or you scat them?
No, I didn't put words to Freddie Freeloader on Miles Day, which I'm sure you know. John Hendricks did.
Album.
John Hendricks did, but I do that. And then I do, I just scat his solo on Now's the Time, Miles' solo.
You recently returned from a series of workshops and concerts in Germany, and later this week you're going to France, I understand.
Tomorrow.
And then in early December you'll be touring Japan.
Yes.
Today's your 86th birthday?
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you, Leonard.
You worked at a day job until you were 58. Are you making up for lost time now?
I don't know. All of a sudden, I guess people are taking me serious. Say, hey, she must be serious. She's still trying to do it. So, no, but even when I was working in an office, you know, I worked in an office because I had to take care of my little girl at the time. She was a baby, so. But I did the music. I always found a place to do the music, and that's what I tell the students. You might have to support this music until it can support you. And there's a whole chapter in my book that Ellen Johnson so graciously and so wonderfully wrote on my teaching and
so this,
my whole attitude.
This is an authorized biography.
Pardon me?
This is an authorized biography.
Yes.
And this, the story that's told growing up, it's rather sad. You had a hard, scrabble childhood.
I did.
That was marked by a series of abandonments.
Yes.
Your mother wasn't there for you?
No, she couldn't help herself. She was very young when she had me, and my father left her, I think. I didn't see my father until I was like towards the end of his life, you know.
And then your grandparents.
My grandparents raised me.
But they were not exactly the ideal.
Well, they couldn't help it. I mean, she had a lot of children, my grandmother. She had 10 kids. And I was part of that family. And there was a lot of alcoholism on my grandfather's side. So I grew up in alcoholism, so I know all about that. And my mother, unfortunately, died from the disease. So when I went to live with her in my teens, you know, I didn't stay there very long with her. I left home. As soon as I got out of high school, I had a job, and I was taking care of me.
But later, when you got involved in the jazz world, there was not only alcohol, there was a lot of drugs.
Yes.
Had you been prepared for witnessing that because of what you'd seen when you were a kid?
Well, you know, sometimes that disease is just hereditary. The alcoholism was hereditary for me, I believe. But Charlie Parker was, contrary to what a lot of musicians say about Bird, he never encouraged me or anybody to use drugs, you know. He was always, don't do this, don't do this.
Others
It'll
did it
kill
just
you.
Simply because he was their hero.
Yeah, that's right.
You moved back to Detroit from Pennsylvania?
When I was about, I was about 14, I guess.
With your mother?
Yes, to live with my mother.
And was that still a problem?
Well, yeah, I had a ugly stepfather who took advantage of me, so I had to get out of there.
Why do you think those four notes, which we mentioned earlier, some listeners might remember them as the opening of the R&B song, The Hucklebuck, were so significant to you when you heard them?
Well, you know, I'd been singing ever since I was a little kid because it was an escape for me. I was so unhappy, but I always felt good when I sang. So I sang all the time. I was constantly singing. And I know I had an uncle who was like my brother. He was about 3 years older than me. He said, "Will you shut her up? She never wants to stop. Shut her up. She can't sing." You know, but I kept singing anyway. And it helped me. And so I didn't know what kind of music I wanted to sing, but I was on a couple of talent shows in Pennsylvania and also in Detroit later. But I remember this guy sent a letter. He found out where we lived in Pennsylvania, and he sent a letter to me, and my grandmother opened it, and this guy was proposing. And my grandmother wrote the letter back, and she said, "I don't think so, mister. She's only 8 years old." He thought I was older.
You were about 16 when you heard Now's the Time by Charlie Parker?
I was about 14 or 15, yeah.
There's a quote from you in the book regarding the first time you heard Charlie Parker in a live performance at Jazz at the Philharmonic. You said, "It was incredible. I knew in that moment that I was right, that this is the music for me. This is the music I want to dedicate my life to because it frees me, it helps me. Bird was my savior, and I have him to thank."
That's right.
There was an epiphany?
Well, you know, it also happened when I heard Now's the Time, because I said, "Oh, this looks weird. This looks strange. Charlie Parker and his reboppers. I said, "Oh, I wonder what that sounds like." Four notes, and I was hooked.
How long after you heard him were you able to meet Charlie Parker?
Well, he came to Detroit, and actually I wrote my blues, and in my blues I sing about how I tried to get in the club to hear him sing, and I forged my mother's birth certificate and wore a hat with a veil, and the guy at the door said, "Hey, little white girl, go home and do your homework." So Bird was by the door. He heard that, and I went around in the alley. I said, "I'm going to hear this music."
You were a little white girl.
Yeah.
You were a little white girl going to predominantly black clubs and black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Was that okay with everybody?
No, it was terrible. I mean, I was always getting taken down to the police station or being stopped by police, you know.
What are you
asking
doing here?
Why. Yeah, I started telling them I was black. I said, "I got to get out of here. I'm, you know, this is where I want to be. And secondly, I'm colorblind. I just know people for what they are and who they are, and that's the only way I can get through my life is to be with people I want to be with."
My guest is Sheila Jordan, who is the subject of a biography called Jazz Child, a portrait of Sheila Jordan written by Ellen Johnson. Detroit was a home to a lot of jazz musicians during the 40s and 50s.
Yes, it was.
Thadden, Elvin Jones, Milt Jackson, Kenny Burrell, the future Yusuf Lateef, Pepper Adams. It must have been a very exciting time.
Well, yes, because I hung out with Barry Harris, Kenny Burrell, and Tommy Flanagan. We were all the same age, approximately the same age. And there was a club, though, in downtown Detroit called the Club Sudan, and they didn't sell alcohol there, so we could go there and hear the music.
When did you start singing professionally to modern jazz?
I guess when I came to New York, I was always doing, like, sitting in with gigs. I mean, when Bird would come to town in Detroit, which wasn't that often, but when he would come to town, he'd always ask Skeeter, Mitch, and I to sit in, and we'd do our bebop head.
You were part of a little group.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Skeeter, Mitch, and Gene, we were called. And we would do all the Charlie Parker heads, and we'd sing in his ear, and he'd say, come on up and sing it with me. So we'd get up on stage and sing with Bird. That was a thrill. Dizzy Gillespie, too.
You wrote original lyrics to Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight, and and your future husband, Duke Jordan, heard you sing that?
I don't know. Yes, he did. I was at the Club Sudan, and I sang Round Midnight and sang the lyrics that I wrote, which Tommy Flanagan hated. He said, those are raggedy lyrics.
But Duke wound up getting you connected to your future husband.
Absolutely. But Duke, you know, said she sings on the chord changes, and I was singing on the changes. And he was very surprised about that.
Well, for listeners who don't understand, if you're playing an instrument and you play on the chord changes, that's a lot easier to work out. You just know where your fingers have to be. But it's not so easy to do that when you're singing.
Yeah, well, I heard the chord changes in my ear, so.
You then moved to New York.
Then I moved to New
York. Because
this
was the center of jazz?
I moved to New York to be closer to Charlie Parker's music, and I moved to New York because I wanted to get away from all the racial prejudice and from being put down with the people that I wanted to be with. I was colorblind, man. I didn't see. I just knew people for what they were and how I felt.
And Detroit was a lot worse than New York?
Oh, it was terrible. It was just terrible. I almost got Barry Harris killed. We went to a club he was playing at, and Skeeter, Mitch, and I sang, and we were leaving the club, and when we walked out the door, Barry said, run, run. All of the guys that were sitting at the bar, the white guys, it was a Polish bar, chased us. If they had caught us, they would have killed us. We just got on the Woodward Avenue streetcar in time. So that was terrible. But I came to New York thinking, I want to be near Bird's music, and I also want to, to free myself from this racial prejudice.
And Charlie Parker obviously appreciated you. He used to introduce you as the singer with the million-dollar ears.
Yeah, he told me that when I was a kid, yeah.
And then you married Duke Jordan, his pianist of the time.
I did.
Had a baby called Tracy in 1954. And how did that change your life?
You mean having Tracy?
Yeah.
Well, it didn't change my life so much, except that I had somebody in my life that I could love and who would love me back. And so I supported her, you know. I took care of her. I did the best I could as a single mother, you know, because Duke, unfortunately, had the cunning, baffling, powerful disease of heroin addiction, and he couldn't help, so he was never there. But
almost everybody you knew was taking drugs.
Oh, they all wanted to be like Bird. They thought they could play like Bird, you know, but they couldn't.
And Charlie Parker, when he was clean, said, you know, I play better when I'm not high, so they should have listened to
him. There you go. So that's so true. But you don't know that at the time. But anyway, when I came to New York, I thought I was going to be in the city that where everybody was accepted, and I was badly mistaken. Yes, on the jazz scene, absolutely it was cool. But, you know, I almost got killed on the street just in front of my building where I lived. I had gone out to have a dinner with two artist friends of mine who happened to be Afro-American, and we were coming back, and four guys in the corner bar, four white guys from Jersey, jumped us, and they held three guys held my two friends, and the other guy knocked me down on the street and was kicking me, knocked my tooth out. I was bleeding, and all of a sudden I looked up and I saw a guy walking with a gun. I said, that's it. I'm going to die over this, but I know I'm right. He was a plainclothesman. He saved my life.
You were the second woman vocalist signed to Blue Note Records.
That's true.
And you were working, and yet at the same time, you had to do day jobs until you were 58 years old?
Yes. Well, I didn't go out there and try to push, you know, and I didn't have an agent.
Which had a lot of fans.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And I had my little job at the Page Street two nights a week, and I had my office job, and I wasn't out there trying to really do anything except keep the music alive and support myself and my daughter.
Later in your career, you became one of the pioneers of vocal jazz education. You had studied with Lenny Tristano, and
the
now
great you, Lenny Tristano.
You're teaching at City University of New York, mm-hmm. among other institutions. Any of your students go on to make you proud?
Well, then I also started. I didn't start it. It was beginning, and the teacher left, and I took over Jazz in July in the summer for 2 weeks.
We're going out with you singing "The Crossing" from your album with Cameron Brown called "Celebration." Sheila Jordan is the subject of Ellen Johnson's biography called "Jazz Child: A Portrait of Sheila Jordan." It is published by Bowman and Littlefield, and I thank you so much for being on our show. It's been such a pleasure.
Well, aren't you the sweetest to have me? And on my birthday, what a beautiful birthday present. Thank you so much, Leonard.
But
thank
better
you.
To listen to you sing than to hear me sing happy birthday.
I'd like to hear you sing.
I'll do it when we're off the air.
Okay.
There is no time or season, and there is no fear or strain. Take your troubles to the crossing. It's where joy